Brigadier Cavalry will 12.
And in these brigades, that there would be a higher proportion of British troops. Now, I ought to emphasize here, the British and Indian troops, especially the British and Gurkha troops, were complementary to each other. They both fought better, in a way, when they were together than when they were apart. One reason was they liked to show off to each other. The other was, just like in an orchestra, the conductor uses each instrument according to what it can best produce, noise it can best produce. So a commander can use the different units under his command. The British the English are ideal at defence and are stubborn and bloody-minded, but not so good in attack. The Scots and the Welsh are good at attack. The Indians are very good, especially at pursuit and mopping up. They can be also stubborn in defence. Anyway, they can all help each other. I won't go into that anymore. Now, this brings me back to Rice. The Indian Army Service Corps was always trying to save money, and it was penny-pinching. So the average troop, although he knew how to cook rice in his mother's house, presumably, it was Wingate who taught them that rice could be cooked in 20 minutes. We were first told by the Gurkhas that they had to have a halt for 2.5 hours to cook their meal. And so Wingate did a demonstration, and this is just one demonstration he did, but I think it most impressed me. He gathered the battalion around with the youngest sitting in front, and then the NCOs, the Naiks, Havildars, and Subedars around the back, and then the British officers. And he came up, he couldn't speak Gurkhali, although he tried to learn, and he took some dry sticks out of the back of his pack. He did this all by mime, by charade. He then put them down, lit them, ordinary match, and then put some more sticks on those till he got a good fire. He then set his alarm clock and poured out water from his water bottle into the canteen. He then measured out a certain amount of rice from a sock. We used to carry our rice in a sock and put it in. He then put some salt in, and then he sat on his haunches. He used to sit on his haunches. And he would wait, and they're all sitting around like this. And he waited, and he'd hum possibly some Arabic or Jewish songs whilst he waited for the 20 minutes. After 20 minutes, the water would be boiled away. He'd stir the rice, of course. And he'd stir it round. And then he picked up the canteen, he took a spoon, and whilst all these eyes were on him, he took a spoonful and blew on it to cool it down, and put the rice in his mouth, and he'd start munching, and a great smile went across his face, and all the Gurkhas smiled with him. You should see their faces. I was watching this. And then he went around against their religious principles, and he offered rice to them all, to different people from this, to the Havildar, Jemadars, to the youngest soldiers, aged about 16, and so on like that, and to the British officers. And he converted them in one go as to how to make rice in 20 minutes, so they didn't need their great pot. Most of the Gurkha officers had been recruited since the war and weren't weren't bound by the sort of traditions, but the senior Gurkha officers, the kind of two of the company commanders, were dead against Wingate, and they were furious at this, that Wingate telling the Gurkhas what to do without it going through their own chain of command. The Gurkha commander, Colonel Alexander, was tried to help, but he was a weak man. He really was. It was unfortunate. And he was a nice man, but he tried to be as loyal as he could to Wingate, but he couldn't compete with some of the company commanders who were anti-Wingate and who were writing to Delhi and subversive remarks about Wingate. There was a lot of disloyalty about it. I may say that the major one was commanded a column, and due to his not following Wingate's precepts of column marching, column bivouac, and so on, his column was surprised by the Japanese and partially wiped out and dispersed. It never existed again. So that was a lesson.
The rice demonstration took place in Jhansi, did it?
In Pataria, Pataria. I give that as an example of how he had got down to it all. And I think I'll keep on tactics, the use of mortars. I won't go into it too much, I think. The use of machine guns in the attack, which I used very successfully on the second Wingate operation. And I found out, of course, the instructors from High, that's the infantry weapons school, they were all firing machine guns at 2,000 yards and having lines of defense and enormous arcs of fire and so on at ranges. Wingate taught what I later found out was a German method of use of machine guns. In the great German success and breakthrough in 1918, March 1918, their tactic was to have Vickers or the heavy machine guns to come up behind the attacking platoon right forward, and as soon as the platoon met resistance, the machine guns would take up their position and give covering fire. In my case, I used this in the second operation, and just before Mogam, we were going along a range of hills, and I can say at one time we got the machine guns within 15 yards of the Japanese positions. We put a bit of tracer in amongst them, and then the machine guns would fire from side to side, and we'd send another company around, and they'd get as close as possible to the arc of the machine gun fire, which would be visible from the tracer, and then at some given word, the machine guns would stop, and the outflanking company would charge and usually find the Japanese still in their holes, covering their heads, and could eliminate them. This was a method which Wingate taught us and was wholly successful. And I was amazed afterwards to find out that the Germans had used this method in 1918. I also hear from the modern army that this method is still being taught. But it just shows that Wingate was very practical and had seen a lot of warfare, which he imparted to us. In his use of mortars, again, we used mortars, 3-inch mortars, a lot. Some columns didn't, and some brigades or battalions in the second operation never used their mortars because they were so stuck with British ideas of how to use mortars. We used mortars on all occasions. They were our heavy weapons. And later in the second Wingate operation, I used to use up to 1,000 mortar shells a night when the Japanese were attacking. But time and again, I would Well, we would pace out. No, this, when we got into column, we would pace out where our ambush point was, and then go on 100 yards further and take compass bearing and come back to our mortars and set the mortars so they could open up on the path which we had left just about where the Japanese would form up. And at least twice this worked perfectly. Vickers machine guns, I told you about how using them in at short distances, they were devastating. In one case later on, we ambushed a battalion on the move. We put in a second ambush where they tried to go round us. I had forestalled that. And then the mortars came down when they were all bunched up. And then they followed us back into the... They followed the ambush party back into the column. I had, in this particular case, couldn't always do it, I had chosen a declivity where, which Wingate, one of Wingate's ideas, says you could put your horses and mules in a bowl so that any firing wouldn't hit them. And the Japanese came on after the first two setbacks and to our perimeter. Of course, we didn't have barbed wire. And there they were met by two Vickers machine guns fire and our Brens rifle fire. And it completely devastated them. Again, not high teaching. I used to say never use less than a belt at a time. I think I've emphasized how Wingate did teach us in detail. Now, there was one thing which nobody had experience of, and that was mules. Possibly the 3rd, 2nd Gurkhas might have had some experience. Wingate taught us in this manner. He made the officers work in the mule lines, do feeding the mules, scrubbing them out, doing this, that, and the other, so that we could load mules and unload mules, all the question of their harnesses, and to groom them, and so on. This was done by officers, I think, and few of the senior NCOs. He then formed a column entirely of officers and NCOs, and we marched through the scrub jungle in central India for about, I think it was about a fortnight, and we had to look after the mules. If mules broke away, we had to chase them, collect them, and do this, that, and the other. By the end of it, I think it was a fortnight or 3 weeks, really every one of us knew a hell of a lot about mules, and also we had confidence in them. We found, Wingate was telling us what to do. For instance, when you lead a mule, you should never look back at his face. You should go forward confidently. If you're crossing some stream or going up a steep rock or something like that, just walk ahead, and it's amazing what the mule would do. We were taught how to load them, put different loads on them, how always to allow for their width when choosing where the column marched. In fact, as column commander, I very often used to be in front, and I got into a habit that I wouldn't go through an area where the trees were too close together, because I was thinking of the mules. Then the officers went back to their battalions, to their own columns, and formed and taught their men how to deal with mules. I should say at this time the battalions were divided up into four columns each, four of the Gurkhas and four of the King's Liverpool. Later on, the King's Liverpool had such a wastage due to people being unfit and there weren't the reinforcements that they were reduced from four columns to three columns. So we went into battle with four Gurkha columns and three 13th King's columns and a headquarters columns which looked after Wingate, because Wingate insisted on going in with us. And we later on, I ran, having trained the commandos, 142 commandos, who were all very good men. A lot of them had seen action. They'd been in commandos in Syria, and they were the only people in the force who had seen action. They were divided up into small detachments with an officer, a sergeant, and about 10 or 15 men, and joined each column. A number of them had been with me on the retreat from Burma. They were a very good lot, and I had a very good Sergeant Major Blaine, who later became Major Blaine, B-L-A-I-M, and also my second-in-command was a wise man whom I'd had in Maymew. And they were the people who could do the demolitions, who could fight best and everything else in the columns. I mention this because it has been mulled over between some of the column commanders who came out, including George Dunlop, an excellent Royal Scots officer who commanded a Gurkha column like I did, whether we couldn't have done the job of blowing the railway with the commando company plus some signals alone. Well, this gets on to the purpose of the operation and Wingate's view. Wingate's idea was that Burma was not a suitable country or people for guerrilla warfare, because the average Burmese of the plain, as opposed to the hill tribes like the Kachins, Karens, and Chins, and they were anti-British. And you cannot carry out guerrilla warfare if the people themselves are against you. This had been proved time and again on the retreat, and was proved again when we went in there. So any force sent in had to be strong enough so it couldn't be attacked or wiped out by local militia. So he chose the size about 400 strong. It was a bit unwieldy. Some people criticized us carrying mortars and machine guns all that way. But this is because they did not know how to use them, or didn't believe Wingate's teaching. In my column, and in George Dunlop's column, I think they're two most successful, and to a certain extent Bernard Ferguson's column, we used our Vickers machine guns and our mortars to great effect. The other thing was, I think one of the purposes of this force and the operation, when in Wavell's mind, and possibly Amory's mind, was that we would be a prototype and an example to others. Now, the great advantage of special forces is that you can wipe them out. You can disband them. If they're not good enough. I've given the analogy, if you spill something on the kitchen floor, you can use a rag to wipe it up and then you can throw it away. So with a special force. But Wingate, of course, believed it was wrong to ask for volunteers from the army and form a special force from scratch. He felt that you should take existing units and train them into a special force and to weed out a small proportion, only 5 or 10% of people who are unsuitable, physically mainly, and that was a much better, you'd have get much better results. Also, it would have an effect on the rest of the army. Now, I believe that it is, again, in military history, that where an army or country has suffered a disaster and you have to rebuild from scratch, one method is or to form small units which you train and arm so they become specialized elite units, and they go in and you put them against opposition which is not very strong, and they go in and gain victories. They are praised and enhanced, and the rest of the army says, my God, if those bastards can do it, we can do it. And they probably can, but they need that example. This was the origin of the commandos at home, and I think of the Chindits in India and of the independent companies in Australia. In all cases, they were the standard bearers, showing how things could be done. They made mistakes, and people could learn from their mistakes, make alterations, and so on and so forth. But they showed each particular country that this was possible. This was certainly the best thing which the First Wingate operation did. We got a lot of praise when people heard that we'd marched 200 miles behind the Japanese lines. We'd been away for 3 months. We'd marched up to 1,500 miles. We'd blown up the railway and marched and come back, and that two-thirds of the units had reached India. They were amazed because they thought at that time the Japanese were invincible, and so they said, my God, we can do this. We can do this easily. And they could, and they did later. And that, I think, was one of the most important things of the Wingate operation. That was why Wavell and his more far-seeing generals supported Wingate. They knew his crustiness, his that he would upset people and so on. They knew all that, and they took into account, and they let him form this unit. I'll stop there because I'll come back to that just before we go in. Now, the various visitors we had, General Wavell came down and visited us. Wingate happened to have malaria at the time, with a temperature about 104, and myself and a chap called John Jeffries, who was in the 142 commando, who had been in the Royal Navy, and we looked after Wavell, and we sank a bottle of whiskey with him, and we talked long into the night whilst Wavell was in this dak bungalow. Dak, D-A-K, is a rest house for travellers, which was nearby where we were. Wingate was capable of going, showing his Wavell all around, his unit, this, that, and the other, and Wavell didn't say anything very much, but he saw the whole situation. He later that evening, he pumped us dry of all what we were doing, and this, that, and the other, and then he pushed off without saying anything, as was his wont. When we were going to march in from the Imphal plain, Wavell flew down especially to see us, and then as we marched off, he saluted us. It was made a point in the thing that he saluted us because he thought we were a forlorn hope and there wasn't much chance of our getting back. But his idea then, we were supposed originally to go in to upset the communications of the Japanese, whilst four corps, who were based on Imphal Plain under General Schoons, and had three divisions or more, were to make an attack. Wavell was being pestered by Churchill, saying, "Why don't you attack? Why don't you attack? Why don't you attack?" The one main reason why he couldn't attack was that India was in uproar. There was revolts going on all over central and eastern India. I think I mentioned this before about Slim. I said Slim had 200,000 men. He had 100 battalions, which is less than 200,000 men, looking after Bengal alone. There were riots all over the place. Only yesterday I was talking to an Indian cavalry officer, and he remembered, as I did, when in Lucknow they burnt three or four RAF officers and a number of British nurses, both in Lucknow and Cawnpore. British troops were used for retribution, and they did it. In Jhansi once, the sudden riot killed off a number of the 13th Kings. The 13th King's company went in and caught as many of the Indians responsible and killed them. This was all hushed up. All over the country, this was. Once, I gave you these examples of my own thing. Once I was in Old Delhi, and I tried to go to the railway station. I went in a tonga, fortunately, T-O-N-G-A. I was in a tonga, oblivious of the riots going on, and took this tonga, fortunately driven by a Mohammedan, to the station. As we came within about half a mile of the station, we went over a broad bridge and started going down the other side. You couldn't turn the tonga. Tonga's a two-wheeled carriage with one horse, and the passenger sits facing backwards. And there was a riot going on with the Hindus destroying buildings, looting buildings, killing, as we didn't know at the time, a lot of Mohammedans, and there's an awful lot of people looking on. Our route took us down the hill of the bridge and then turned left, and they saw us. I was in uniform, and the youth started to chase us. It became like one of those Wild West shows where the film shows where the pursuers get closer and further away again. They started throwing stones, and fortunately there was mainly spectators on either side and watched this. And when they started throwing stones, I tried to catch them. And if I did catch them, I pretended I'd playing cricket. And everybody gave a cheer when I caught one or did this, that, and the other. But it was very frightening being chased by a mob. And eventually the driver whipped his horse